Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is Hashtag No Limits, and I am your host, Shelley Kino. Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. I believe there's no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. It literally dissolves into its cells and then reforms into the butterfly. That's not easy, but I think that gives us hope about what we each can become, no matter what we are doing in our life and what we think our future looks like. I'm really excited today to have a returning guest, Richard Lavoie. He is someone who has, I realized the last time he was on, influenced me and how I think about things so greatly. And it's such an honor to have you back again today. So how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm delighted to be back. I had a really nice time last time. Let's see if we can do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have been, as it says at the bottom of the screen, you I think, are a specific learning disability expert. How long have you been in the field of special education, and has your focus always been on SLD?
Yes, it has. And it's kind of an odd trip, as everybody's career is. I was a undergraduate special ed. I mean, I knew it's what I wanted to do forever. I did a show of hands one time at a big engagement and asked how many people, it was a special ed audience, how many people in the audience who were special ed teachers had someone in their life who experienced a special ed situation. And the overwhelming number of hands went up. And that same story for me. I had a cousin who had, you know, realized now that it was probably autism. We didn't know what it was back in the wagon train days, but I loved them and seemed to be able to work with them, and nobody else could. And when his mom and dad had trouble, they'd call me to be with them, and I was like 10 years old. So I knew it's something I liked to do, and I thought it might have been good at it. So yeah, I was an undergraduate special ed, and then I went to work at a residential school for kids with specific learning disabilities. So I mean, if you do the math, it's since I've been in the field since 1972 and always in this area. There's a number of fascinating areas of special ed. This is just one that really captured my imagination, and that's been doing it for, you know, do the math, almost 50 years.
Yeah. And so much of what I have learned from you, and it definitely applies in all the areas of special education. It doesn't just apply to the specific people who have the specific learning disability eligibility. So let's talk about that a little bit more. What exactly does that mean? How does it look?
Well, I have kind of a hot button, and I know we've only got an hour, and I don't want to go until the sun goes down, but I've really got a hot button about terminology. It's a source of frustration for me that we still can't nail down the definitions and the terminology. I mean, if a doctor from Missouri calls a doctor from Massachusetts and says, you know, looks like this guy's got this thing with his appendix, both doctors know what they're talking about. And yet the terminology in special ed is just so scattered and specific, state specific, sometimes city and town specific. Our daughter had some challenges growing up. We lived literally 2 miles from the New York border. She qualified for services in Connecticut. If we moved 2 miles down the road, she would no longer be learning disabled. She wouldn't qualify for the services, which is ludicrous when you consider the field of almost 60 years old. So the terminology really bothers me because we can't seem to come to consensus. But SLD, specific learning disabilities, for those of you younger folks in the audience, it's kind of old wine in a new bottle. That was a term we used in the 70s. Then it kind of disappeared. And now it seems to be having resurgence, which is fine with me. And basically what it says is the kid has a learning disability, but it has a specific impact on the language arts. When I say language arts to the typical person, what does that mean? A grammar? It really got a specific definition. Basically, I even brought a little old school get it on camera. You know that there are basically two vehicles for language, written and oral. I can either say to you, I'm going to go to the store, or I can write you a note that says I'm going to go to the store. So the two ways I've got to communicate are written and oral. And the two media are expressive and receptive. Right now, I'm expressing language, you're receiving it. The language arts is the combination of all four of these. You know, written expressive, which is ability to write, written receptive, the ability to read, oral expressibility to speak and oral receptive, the ability to listen. And the SLD means that one, two, three, or four of those things are compromised. It's really, really based on the ability to deal with language, which is really good because that really is the crux of it. There are all kinds of concomitant problems that our kids have. But basically, SLD says the kid is having difficulty in the areas of thinking, speaking, reading, writing, spelling, math, or processing, that those are real diagnosable things. I was just mentioned off camera that I was in St. Louis yesterday, and I had a big discussion, as I often do, about the terms learning disability and learning difference. I will go to my grave, which I hope is a while from now, but I will go to my grave defending the word disabilities. 30 of the years I spent in this field were at residential schools for kids with learning disabilities, literally putting them to bed at night, waking up in the morning. I know this kid, and the bottom line is these kids have a disability. When I speak to kids, I say difference, but the idea of calling it a difference really rubs me the wrong way because it's more than that. It's more pervasive. I'm somebody who spends a lot of my time speaking to legislators, trying to get more money for our kids. We're not getting the money we need. We call it a disability, call it a difference, and it's all just going to fly away. So I do call it a difference. This is a neurologically based, observable problem that is very pervasive and impacts on every aspect of the kid's life. There's a whole lot of research now that indicates it even impacts them when they're asleep, that many of our kids have sleep disorders, particularly the ADD kids. Have sleep disorders that impact them when they're asleep. So to call it a difference, frankly, I think it's insulting to the kids. You know, to call it a challenge, you know, that's a term people use. I've got a friend who had a major spinal injury when he was 15, and he is now in his 50s, and he spent his entire life in a wheelchair, using a wheelchair, because he has no use of anything south of his waist. And he said, if one more person says that I'm challenged, he said, that would indicate that there's a flight of stairs there. But if I really, really tried, I'd be able to make it up those stairs. He said, I can't. My legs don't move. He said, so we keep trying to be sensitive and come up with the new terminology. I use learning disabilities, and I'm kind of pleased that the whole specific learning disabilities has come back. It's not a diagnosis. In fact, I was speaking to somebody yesterday, and they said, My school diagnosed my child with learning disabilities. No, schools don't diagnose. Schools identify. You know, they take information, testing done by people, them or somebody else. They take observations. They take interviews with the kid and the parents and everybody. And it's school job to identify. It's not the school's job to diagnose. And so when somebody says to me, the school diagnosed my kid, I kind of bring them up short on it because it just isn't the case. I'm glad SLD has returned. I think it does really kind of hit the kid where it hurts, which is in the areas of language.
Yeah. And Fran is joining us from Southern Illinois. She said, howdy, in her first comment. And then she said, it's so true. Even parents can't agree what terminology to use. Yeah. And there is, it's unfortunate because sometimes we get stuck on the terminology and I feel that it divides us even more sometimes. Yeah. So I will be honest. It's only been in the recent couple of years that I have gone back to using the word disability, because to me, I didn't like that word, because if you broke it apart, it said, well, you don't have the ability. And so my philosophy has always been that everyone can learn.
Yeah.
And so I've always referred to my students as those who learn differently.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that is kind of different than what you were saying?
I get that. I really do. And I'm sensitive to that. My thing is, and I've never spoken to many people who feel this way, so maybe it's just a hang up I've got. It's almost insulting to the kid to say, this is a difference. No, this kid lives with this 24/7. It impacts everything he does, every waking moment of his day. And as I said, sometimes when they're asleep, I think what people have trouble with, and I made another little handout here, because I don't know if we talked about this last time. People, didn't we talk about this before?
No, we did not.
Then I'm trying to have a difficult time going old
school. I know, finding the camera.
People use the terms impairment, disability, and handicap interchangeably as if they mean the same thing. And they don't. They're very different from each other. And yet we'll say the kid's got an impairment, is a handicap disability. Basically, impairment, I use myself as an example. I'm developing a pretty good case of arthritis in my right hand. I knew it was time. My parents had it. My grandparents had it. Now it's my turn. And so I've got a pretty bad case of arthritis going in my right hand. The impairment is that there's fluid around my knuckles, which make my knuckles like flexible. That's the impairment. The disability is that I can't make a fist. That's the impact it has. I mean, you can't make a fist. The handicap is that I can't hold a golf club anymore. I can't hold a tennis racket anymore. And I have difficulty opening jars. So the impairment is the fluid. The disability is the inability to make a fist. The handicap is opening jars. When I'm right now, as I'm sitting here talking to you, I have the impairment. I still have the fluid. I have the disability. I still can't make a fist, but it's not a handicap because I don't need to make a fist to talk to you. So the job of special ed is to try to stop the handicap, the disability from becoming a handicap. The example I use, again, I said I have trouble opening jars. Well, I went to CVS and found one of this little red thing that just put around the jar and you turn it. Now I can open jars. I took the disability and I didn't let it become a handicap by taking remedial measures. That's what special ed is all about. You know the kid's got an impairment. You know he's got a disability. The way you get your job as a special educator and a special ed parent is to make sure that disability doesn't become a handicap. So the kid's got an impairment, has visual memory problems. Therefore, he has difficulty reading. Therefore, he can't read his math book. You put his literature book. You put the book on tape. You prevent that disability is no longer a handicap. So that's really what it's all about. And again, it bothers me. It's a tad of an embarrassment, frankly, Shelley, that we are a field that's 60 years old and still hasn't come up with definitions that I can talk to you in Missouri and you know what I'm talking about out here in Massachusetts. It really is unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think it is a shame. And Fran says it depends on the situation, which terms she uses for herself and her kids.
Yeah.
Fran became a disabled person about 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so her experiences, she and I do a different podcast where we just talk about what it's like being a person disabled and having raised two children who are now adults that also have disabilities. And then I speak about things of special education from the mm-hmm. teacher side of things. And her insight is so valuable to me because, you know, she is in the population where, you know, parents aren't going to necessarily speak to me in the same way that they're going to speak to another parent.
Right.
And so she can enlighten me about a lot of things. And and she's told me of situations where there's been that division because within that group that's supposed to be so supportive, or you want it to be so supportive of the parent group, people are bickering because somebody's using this term or that term. And that's where I say, sometimes I worry that we get hung up on those terms instead of supporting or providing what's needed at the moment.
You know, they're also, I'm sorry, your friend, what's your name?
Fran.
Mm-hmm. I think Fran will relate to this too. When I'm dealing with parents, special needs parents, there also is a very unfortunate and frankly unattractive totem pole among special ed parents. I was working with a group of parents, and it was an organization for kids with learning disabilities, and we're trying to put together something, a program. And they spent I always used to let them spend the first 10 minutes of the meeting kind of venting for the reason you said, Shelley. Sometimes parents need to talk to parents. Now let's let them vent. And they would sit there and say, you know, my kid's not being accepted by the typical kids, and he got bullied in the schoolyard, he got picked on there, and this kind of thing went on and on. They rightfully had something to complain about. And so then I said, okay, what we're going to talk about today is we're going to have kind of a fun drive. We'd like to raise money. And it's always good if you got a couple of organizations working together. And the Down Syndrome Association wants to pair with us and sponsor this conference. Three of the same people said, well, I don't want my kids associating with Down syndrome kids. I said, you're doing exactly what you've spent 10 minutes complaining about. You're building some kind of, you know, my kid has learning disability, but God knows he's not mentally impaired. Well, why are we fighting with each other? I think that I'm a huge believer in working closely with parents, and it's really been my whole career. I'm in the process of writing a book about it. But the politics, even in parent organizations, get a little bit crazy around the rather foolish issue of terminology.
Yeah, and Fran says, "Oh my."
Yeah. Well, let me give you a quick, totally off-base example. There is a huge movement about using the R word, calling anybody a retard. A politician who remain nameless, but a former governor of Florida, governor of Alaska, said one time that that using the R word is every bit as evil as using the N word. And I was speaking at a college, and they said, you know, before you're going to speak to 400 students, before you do, we'd like to have a ceremonial signing where you sign our new petition. And what's our new petition? That we'll never use the R word. Okay, I get that. But look at the history of it. If you and I were professionals talking in the early part of the 20th century, you know what the terminology was for the four levels of mental impairment? Imbecile, moron, feeble-minded, and idiot. Those are the four terms that professionals use to describe the levels of mental impairment. And it was terms they came up with great affection. Idiot is from the Latin meaning without a shield. In the Roman armies, if there was a soldier that was very weak and not a very good fighter, they wouldn't give him a shield because he's going to end up losing it. And it wasn't disrespectful. It was just, you know, and they came up with these really great terms. Well, of course, after a while, they became playground talk. You're an idiot. You're a moron. You're an imbecile. So in the 60s, they got together and said, got to change those terms. They came up with mentally retarded, which is really a lovely word. Retarded. It just means slowed down. It doesn't mean stop. It's really a great word. Well, of course, that became slang. So we'll come up with another word. But don't call it hate speech. I mean, that's not hate speech. You know, let's get rid of it. And I would never call anybody that. But look at the history of it. And again, that's what frustrates me now that I'm kind of looking at my career in the rearview mirror, is that special ed keeps going down these rabbit holes and fighting these battles that are not, there's plenty of battles worth fighting, but those are battles that aren't worth fighting. They're just not.
Yeah. And I definitely can see that point because, yeah, like I said, we get stuck on words and we're not then providing what needs to be provided because we're so worried about what it's called or what we're saying. Yeah. So Fran says it's what society has done with the terminology that has caused this chaos.
Exactly. Exactly. But we're the experts. We're the ones that ought to be leading society, not kind of following society as they go along. You know, so there was a presidential aide, a doctorate from Harvard, who lost his job in the George W administration, because he said that he thought a bill from Congress was retarded, and he said it on an open mic, and he lost his job. I mean, my argument to the former governor is the N word was always meant to be hurtful. That's why it was designed to be diminutive and to be divisive. Right. The R word wasn't, so you can't compare the two. But again, it just we keep going down these rabbit holes that don't really get us anywhere.
Yeah. So at one time in the law, I think it was in the law, maybe it was just a policy that was followed in order to become eligible. And I try to always say that, you know, like, know that you're not diagnosed, like you mentioned, the school doesn't diagnose, but you're found eligible for something that is now going to provide you special education. So I think it was in the law that at one time you had to be two school years behind in order to get the SLD eligibility.
Right.
Was that in the law?
Yes, it was in the law.
Okay.
And I'll tell you who was very instrumental in getting it out of the law is parents of kids, gifted and talented kids, whatever you call them in Missouri, exceptional, twice exceptional kids. Because they said, look, my kid is functioning on grade level, but he's got an IQ of 160. You know, that's not his potential. The law should want to develop a kid to his potential, not to his grade, but to his chronological grade level. He happened to have been born 10 years ago. So he's in the fifth grade, but this kid is capable of much more. And the law needs to account for that. So yeah, the 2 years below and with all, you know, given the devil they do, the field really only came, the term learning disabilities was coined in 1969. I mean, it really is a relatively new field. In those early years, they're kind of stumbling around in the dark, trying to find, and we had, you know, we don't know, it's all motoric. If you put the kids on balance beams and trampolines, it'll go away. I mean, we knew those kids existed. This group of seemingly really bright kids who just couldn't learn the way we teach. Then we stumbled around in the dark for about 15 to 20 years. But as someone who travels around the country, there's still a lot of school systems stumbling around in the dark.
Yeah. Yes, there are. As someone who doesn't travel as much, but who works with schools all around the country, I'm still amazed at the fact that we still have the trainably mentally handicapped rooms, yeah, and that people still refer to them as such. And
no, I got to admit, I haven't heard that term in a long time. That's very troubling. Talk about a self-limiting term. That basically is, we're not even going to try to educate you. We're just going to, you know, get you put in square pegs and square holes. Wow. That's troubling.
Right. Yeah, very much so. But the thing that always used to surprise other students and oftentimes teachers was within that definition of a specific learning disability, you have to have average or above average intelligence. And so often when people think about special education and someone being eligible for special education, they automatically think less.
Right.
And so I'm happy that has come out of the law, that needing to be two grade levels behind. Mm-hmm. But how do we get people to, I mean, like you said, we've been at this, the law came into effect almost 50 years ago. How do we get people to get it? That you have to have above, you know, this isn't a less than person. This is average or above average.
Yeah. I put a lot of that at the media, Shelley, to tell you the truth. Like the media has done a lousy job of covering special ed. They love making movies and things about kids who are blind and deaf and kids with physical handicap. But the overwhelming majority of kids in special ed are the kids we're talking about. And is almost because, it's, you know, it's not sexy. You know, it's sexy to make a movie about a kid in the wheelchair that plays adaptive basketball. I mean, that's people watch that and they sit and they cry and they have emotions they probably shouldn't have because they shouldn't be pitying our folks. But I really put a lot of it at the media that we've done a really lousy job of educating people. And that's why I said the parent who was so offended, I don't want my kid to be lumped in with those kids. And there's a whole lot of that going on, too. I hate to put it all in the media. My kids are involved in media, but I think the media has done a pretty poor job of explaining what the real SLD kid is to the average person in the street.
Well, and as we started off this episode, it's hard to define that because the experts haven't defined it really well either. And so to have our media really do a good job of it, they would need better from us, the experts first. Just putting information out there in the media, I think would be helpful because we have, you know, 15-20% of the population across the world now has some disability, and we need to know more about it, I think.
Well, if you look, I don't know if you know, but the Fat City video that I did in the early 1800s, but it was 1987.
One of my favorite things.
The definition I used for that is the definition of exclusion. The kid is not functioning in school and yet his modalities are intact. He can visual and auditory is fine. He's not mentally impaired. He's had an opportunity to learn. He's not primarily emotionally damaged. It's definite. The way we used to define the SLD kid is not what he was, but what he wasn't. You take these five disabilities that we know about and you shake them out, and anybody who falls out is the kid with SLD who is not learning and yet he doesn't have any of those disabilities. It wasn't a bad definition. It certainly was a good one for media because it's easy to remember. And I see that coming back too. So, you know, everything that's old is new again, it seems. But it is, and I think we all agree that it's a source of embarrassment that we're not there yet. The best definition I've ever heard of learning disabilities, there are 35 accepted definitions in the country now. And different, Arizona is different from Minnesota. Minnesota is different from Missouri. And the best definition I ever heard was a dad of this 10-year-old hyperactive attention deficit disorder kid with learning disabilities. And he was a wonderful kid, but what a handful. I mean, he was just all over the place. And his father came into my office, uneducated man, never went to college, but a very wise, wise man who adored his kid. And he said, Michael's biggest problem is? And I said, what's that? And he said, ulcers. I said, I didn't know Michael had ulcers. He said he doesn't, but he's a carrier. If you think about that, that's kind of a letter perfect definition of the kids that we all love. They don't have ulcers, but man, everybody around them eventually gets them.
Aww.
I say that with great respect and affection from the kids I devoted my life to, but you notice a lot of cry sometimes.
So that leads into a very great question that you and I kind of discussed ahead of time. Why is it so difficult with kids with SLD to establish and maintain friendships and relationships in general?
Well, it's my area of specialty, and I'm not selling books here, but this my book is It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend. And in the book, I talk about a quote from a woman named Doreen Cronick. Doreen Cronick was a beloved expert in learning disabilities in the 1960s. Brilliant, made wonderful changes in the field. But she wrote something has stuck with me. I mean, do the math now. It's 60 years old. But listen to what she said, which is a direct answer to your question. To become a friend means to become interested in and somewhat knowledgeable about the other person's interests, to be sensitive to their needs and feelings, to compromise on activities, to laugh off differences, to be supportive, to allow the other person freedom to interact with others and spend time by themselves, to be elated by their successes, share their sorrows sensitively, be able to communicate your pleasure, displeasure, and anger without such communication becoming destructive to either party, and to change and grow as your friend changes and grows. I wonder whether many learning disabled kids possess the sensitivity, empathy, flexibility, and maturity and generate sufficient interest and excitement to maintain such friendships. Now, that is an honor. But basically what she's saying is everything it takes to be a friend and to maintain a friendship, all the skills you need to do that are exactly the skills that our kids don't have. And at that time, when that was written, it was basically saying to mom and dad, understand this kid is never leaving home. He's never going to have any friends. You're going to be taking him to the mall, but he's not going to have anybody there to meet. It was a period in the field that we thought the social stuff not going to happen for these kids. And now, of course, that's different. I mean, we're really doing wonderful things with the social skills. But in terms of why they don't have friends, one of the things I did in the book, which is I think why the book got more than a share of attention, and follow me if you can on this, I followed the path of reading people, the people in reading. When I first started out in the early 70s, you used to get your class list and they'd say, this is Michael, he's got dyslexia. Okay, what do I do with that? And they realized that what they had to do was break the skill of reading down into subskills. So they now you get a list, and you say, this kid's got dyslexia, he has difficulty with visual motor memory, has difficulty with comprehension, difficult with word association. And you get a list of these are subskills in the act of reading that he can't do. That's what I did with the book. I took social skills and broke it into subskills. So instead of saying, look, this kid has got, I'm giving you a kid and he's got social skill deficits. Now you get a thing that says he's a problem with timing and staging. He's got a problem with social memory, problem with social prediction. I've broken it down into skills. And to understand your question and to answer your question, let me tell you, as I do these, you're going to see why the kid has difficulty establishing and maintaining friendship. Timing and staging is one. Timing and staging, which is a huge problem for our kids, is the inability to understand that basically a relationship is a process. It's not a product. It's a process. Someone is not going to be your best friend just because you say, I want you to be my best friend. So here's what happens. A new kid moves into the neighborhood. Billy, the kid in the neighborhood with good social skills, swings by the kid's house. and says, "Hi, my name is Billy. What's your name?" "Bobby." "Hi, Bobby. Nice to meet you. Welcome to the neighborhood. Where do you go to school?" "I go to Kennedy Middle School." "Oh, that's right down the street. That's where I go." We catch the bus across the street there. And, you know, sometimes my brother and I go get in our bikes and go to the mall. Maybe sometime you can do that with us. "Okay, great. Nice meeting you, Bill. Nice meeting you, Bobby." And he drives away. Perfect. Perfect. The first step in the process. And then maybe they'll see each other in the school bus. Or one will be playing hoops the next and they'll go. But that's a great way to start the process. Our kid, the kid who doesn't understand timing and staging, goes running over to the new kid's house and bangs on his door. "My name's Michael. You got to be my best friend. You have to sit next to me on the bus. You can sleep over my house tonight, and I'll sleep over your house tomorrow night. My family goes to Disney World every year, and you can come. When we grow up, your brother can marry my sister." And the new kid says, "Well, stop. You're putting out the fire. Because you don't understand that a relationship is something that develops. You're taking too many liberties. You know, you're putting out the candle by making a relationship, trying to make the relationship happen so fast." The example I use is I had the great pleasure of doing a 12 university tour through Australia, and I'm sitting in one of the auditoria in Sydney, sitting in this auditorium, we had about 500-600 people, and I'm combing it, looking at the audience, and I'm speaking, and I look center stage, two rows back, Mary Farrakhan. This woman that I had taught with 20 years before, we were great friends when we taught together. We kind of went our own ways, went to different schools, and the Christmas cards stopped coming. I had heard through the grapevine she was living out of the country, but I had absolutely, she was the last person I expected to see in the Sydney Opera House. So I get through speaking, and she runs up to the stage, and I run and meet her, and we hug. It was so wonderful to see her. Gave each other a very nice, long hug. She introduced me to her sister, Susan, who lives in Australia and who I had never met. She introduced me to Susan. Did I hug Susan? Well, would have been, I'd never met her before. It would be inappropriate to give her the same hug I just gave to Mary, who I'd known for years. Then that night, they took us out to dinner, the two of them, and took Janet and I out to dinner. And the next night, we took them to dinner. They took us on a tour of Sydney for the day. And the next night, we took them to dinner. And then they dropped us off at the hotel because we were flying out the next day. I gave Mary a big hug. Did I hug Susan? Yeah, it was appropriate now. We knew we'd spent the day together. It was, and you see, that's what I'm talking about. Our kids' inability to understand, that's only one of the 20 skills that I list, but that inability to understand, you can't make a relationship happen just because you want it to happen, and they put out the candle. They don't understand, which is the thrust of the book, what are called social contracts. I use the example, you know, it's mid-afternoon now. You've probably been through 500 social contracts today. I've been in the house, so I haven't been through as many, but I've been through plenty of them, and I'll tell you very quickly what that means. You go to, we have Dunkin's out here. When you go to Starbucks. You get up, going out this morning, you decide you want breakfast. So you stop at Starbucks. You walk into Starbucks. There are 10 people standing in line. You don't know them. You never met them before. You couldn't pick them out of a lineup. But guess what? For about 10 minutes, you've got a social contract with those folks. They have social expectations of you, and you have social expectations of them. Your social expectation to them is to get to the end of the line. Imagine cutting into the line and going to the front of the line, get at the end of the line and wait your turn. Then some people come there standing behind you. Now you got a social contract with them. Your social contract, what they understand you were going to do is move up as the line moves up, get your money ready, be ready to make the transaction. So when it comes your turn, boom, boom, everybody can get to work. So in that little thing at the store, at the coffee shop, you add a dozen social contracts. People had expectations, you had expectations of them. Many of our kids, no idea. No idea of the social contracts. That's one of the reasons for the unpopularity, is they constantly violating social contracts. And the example I use is I did a speaking tour through Hong Kong. And first presentation, I've been doing this a while, Shelley. I know when it goes well, and it really went well. I mean, it went well. Audience response. Very tepid, very mild applause. Nobody made eye contact with me. Nobody came up to see me afterwards. I thought, whoa, I'm going to have a long month here in Hong Kong. So they were taking me to the next venue, and I asked the woman who was um, who was sponsoring it, I said, can I ask you a question? Be honest with me. Yeah. I said, how do you think that went? Oh, well, people were there. We got great reviews. And I said, I was kind of surprised by the audience response. She said, yes, I should have told you, and she should have, that when you speak or entertain in Hong Kong and the audience applauds, the social contract says I'm supposed to return the applause. I was supposed to return to applaud to thank them for their attention. Not only, Shelley, not only did I not applaud, but I put my hands behind my back, which sent them a very clear social signal that they had offended me in some way. Now, so not only didn't they applaud, but none of them came up to see me because they didn't know what they had done that offended me. I tell that story because I'm a nice guy who wanted to do well in Hong Kong, but there's 400 right. people who are still wondering what they did to offend me and why I was offended. The point being, I wasn't doing it to be a jerk. I didn't know the social contract. So I say to parents and teachers, when your kid does something really socially incompetent, think about that incident. I wasn't trying to look like a clown. I just didn't know what my expectations were. And many times kids simply don't know what the social contract requires. And again, typical kid in school is going to go through 500, 600, 700 social contracts a day where people are expecting things of him. He's expecting things. I said one time, not too tongue in cheek, a successful childhood, you got to do three things: share, follow directions, and wait your turn. If you can do all the three things, share, follow directions, wait your turn, you'll do all right. You'll survive your childhood. But if you look at share, follow direction, wait your turn, it's strike one, strike two, and strike three for the kid with learning disabilities, particularly if he's got an attentional problem. So yeah. Those are the reasons why, in fact, the title of the book is So Much Work to Be Your Friend comes from an incident I had where I had two kids who were trying to get a friendship going and they just couldn't. And one of them was railing on the other one about this and that. And the other, the kid said, it is so much work to be your friend. And I thought, it's not supposed to be work. It's supposed to be fun. But that's right. That's why they don't have friends. That's why parents and teachers need to do whatever they can to help them establish friendships. The big mistake parents make is, I've had it. Go outside. There's a bunch of kids out there. Go outside and make a friend. That is every bit as foolish as saying, I'm tired of you being dyslexic. Here's a book. Go in your room and it will come up to you can read. I mean, it really is that foolish to expect a kid on his own to go into a group of kids and establish a friendship. But there's much the parents and teachers can do.
Right. So Fran had asked the question, and I told her while you were talking, she had asked whether it was social contacts or social contracts. And I said it was contracts. So go ahead.
Yeah, I use that term because it's basically a deal. You know, when you go to the coffee shop, you're making a deal with these people you've never met before that you're going to follow the rules. We were waiting for a plane one time and at the gate, and I said to Janet, I have to go use the restroom. I went into the bathroom. There's five guys standing in line when he uses the bathroom. This guy comes in, goes to the front of the line, and turns and says over his shoulder, I've got a plane to catch. Well, what do you think we're doing there? By definition, we all have a plane to catch.
Right.
It's that inability to understand social contracts. And when you're constantly misunderstanding social contracts and violating them, then you develop a negative reputation. And that's the big battle for our kids, is they develop a negative reputation. And in childhood, reputation, forget everything you know about reputation in terms of adulthood, because adult reputation, childhood reputation are very, very different. Adult reputations can change. Shelley, I bet you could name 10 people in your life who you really, really are very fond of and like very much, but you didn't like them when you first met. You can. And there's also the other thing about adult reputation, it can be situational. In other words, I can say, I love Jim Middleton. He's a great friend of mine. I love playing golf with him. He's a great, great friend. I really like him. But I don't like going to restaurants with him because he's rude to the waitstaff. And that embarrasses me, and I don't like when he does that. So, in other words, I can say there's some things I like about Jim, some things I don't. And I didn't used to like Jim, but now I really do. Kids can't do that. Man, if you don't like a kid in the first grade that goes 12 years through school, they can't change the reputation. I remember being with our son Christian walking down the street in our town, and this kid Frank walked by, and I said, hi, Frank. He said, hi, Mr. Loy. How are you? He said, I'm fine. Christian didn't speak to him. And I turned to Kit, and I said, Christian, what are you – you didn't speak. He's been in your grade for years. He lives grounds. Why didn't you speak to him? He didn't speak to you. I hate that kid. Why? Stole my lunch once. When? Second grade. I said, you're a senior. high school, man. What's the statute of limitations on a bologna and cheese? I mean, you got to let it go. But that's what happens. They violate social contracts, then they develop a negative reputation, which is really the clarion call for parents and teachers to get involved.
Right. And I believe that it was you who coined the term the unwritten rules of social interactions.
Yeah. In academically, I call it the hidden curriculum, which is a phrase that has been purloined, but it was mine. And it is the ability to understand the culture of the school, that every school is different from every other school by definition. They have got their own culture. And that's what we're finding out. Kids don't understand. Even if they can match it and master the standard curriculum, which is the reading, writing, spelling, math, and all the subjects, they don't understand the hidden curriculum, which is, you know, sophomores don't go out with juniors. No, I don't know that particular in right. that particular school. That's just part of the hidden curriculum. I don't know why. Right. No, and it'll change next year. But every kid except our kid knows that sophomores don't go out with juniors. And it's a constantly changing environment. Every family has their own hidden curriculum. Every workplace has their own hidden curriculum, and schools do. And our kids don't get it. I tell a story of I worked for Charles Schwab in San Francisco in his foundation for just 6 months. I really didn't like foundation work. It's, you know, let's have a meeting so we can talk about the last meeting. And I'm a school guy. I loved him. He was wonderful. But I went there, and the first week they were so welcoming. Oh, my God. Everybody was just so welcoming and wonderful. And then came the weekend. And I happened to have a speaking engagement in El Paso. And I went to do my speaking engagement, came back on Monday. All of a sudden, the same people being very cool, people just nodding to me, and all these people who have been so welcoming. Wow. So I said to my secretary at the end of the day, I said, something happened over the weekend. You know, what's the deal? She said, well, do you want to know? I said, yeah. She said, well, it's kind of a unwritten rule around here that if you go someplace on the weekend, a project for the organization, you always bring food back and put it in the teacher's lounge. So you went to El Paso, people anticipated that you would bring salsa or something back in the teacher's lounge. When you didn't, they're interpreting it as, oh, well, I saw him eating the food. I left, but I guess he's too, you know, I just didn't understand the hidden curriculum. That wasn't written down anywhere. Thankfully, you had the grace to tell me about it. But every school has its own hidden curriculum, and our kids violate the hidden curriculum. So you can see why they become unattractive social partners, because they're a lot of work. They really are a lot of work. There's things you can do. I told you, my cousin, many of the kids we hung out with, particularly in high school, didn't know how involved he was. And he could, you know, really could barely read. He was severely dyslexic on the far end of the scale. And four or five of us would go out to a hamburger place. And although it's funny, Jack was no longer with us, but we'd be sitting around and I'd take the menu and I'd say, boy, Jack, I can't decide. Do I want to get a hamburger for $1.50 or a hot dog for $1? And that was what I was doing is reading the menu for, and no one knew it. You know, that's kind of a deal we had. But there's a lot the kids can do to help their classmates too.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we as the adults don't always know what the hidden curriculum is in order to be able to help our students navigate through that hidden curriculum. And so we have to be, you know, trying to figure it out sometimes along with our students so that we can give them what they need in order to keep progressing forward. So
The chapter in the book about hidden curriculum, one of the things I encourage, and if there's any special education teachers, please listen to me. Get out of your classroom. The best special ed teachers I know are also involved in regular ed. They're the, you know, maybe the volleyball coach or the head of the, you know, the sponsor of the chess club or the yearbook club. So they get out and don't, you know, consider yourself a saint because you lock yourself in the special ed classroom and never see the light of day. Get out in the community. Get out in that school community and learn what the hidden curriculum is. Talk to the other kids. I used to encourage them to have a meeting with the student council and say, look, this is what hidden curriculum is. What are the rules around this school that I've written down that you know and everybody else knows except the kids I'm here to help. We had with this, I love this, a student council one time. I had that meeting with the student council. You know what they did? Over the summer, they wrote a student curriculum, hidden curriculum handbook for the special needs kids. These are the teachers who get mad if you're late. These are the teachers who don't care. These are the teachers who get mad if you lean back in your chair. These are the teachers who don't care. It's unbelievable. They put together this like secret code book to how to get through. Right. And the example I use, when I went to high school, there were four entrances to the high school, north, south, east, and west. And the standard curriculum said that every door is open at 8 o'clock. You can come in any entrance. But the hidden curriculum said, from 8 o'clock till 8:30, don't go in the west entrance because that's where the tough kids hung out. And if you go in there by yourself, you're going to find yourself in trouble. At 8:30, once the teachers arrive, it's okay. But from 8 to 8:30, don't use the west entrance. Again, standard curriculum, use any door you want. Hidden curriculum, don't use the west entrance. That's what hidden curriculum is all about, and our kids just don't get it.
Yeah, and Fran lives the hidden curriculum life. She says it's good to have those who help get through the hidden curriculum. She has a few in her life. They speak her language.
Yeah.
I don't think she would mind if I shared, but her part of her disability has affected her ability to understand numbers. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult for her. And several people have come alongside of her and helped her tell time and understand money again and deal, you know, her birth date and, you know, all the things that you need numbers for that used to be basically automatic for her.
Yep.
And they are not that way anymore. And so there's a lot of hidden curriculum, even in society surrounding numbers and the things that you're supposed to know and how to present that to people.
Yep.
So what are some things that you recommend to parents that they can do to help their child build those relationships?
Well, let me give you one in-house and one out of the house. In many neighborhoods, in many communities, the social coin of the realm is the play date. Now, a play date, if you've got typical kids, a play date means one mom calls the other, says, drop your kid off at 3 o'clock and pick him up at 7. And that's it. That's what you do when you have a rollicking time and great adventures and great memories. For the kid with a special need, but so, the social, you know, the term is socially incompetent, has social difficulties, you've got to plan a play date like the invasion of Normandy. It has to be planned like you're planning a wedding. And I'm not being facetious about it. You really, or it's going to be a disaster. And then the word's going to go around school. I went to Michael's house and it was a disaster. One more time, the kid's reputation is dented. Some of the things I suggest, and again, for a typical parent, a play date is, you know, call a parent, drop the kid off, pick him up. That's it. You know,
Right. This
kid, some of the things you got to do. First of all, you need to understand. And if you look at the world through the eyes of our kids, you can understand why play dates are such a problem and see if this doesn't ring true. I'm a special needs kid. I'm being bullied by the other kids. I don't feel safe at school. I don't feel safe in the school bus. I'm really having a difficult social time. My castle, my world is my room and my house. That's my world. So they assume if I have I'm king here, and you know, in my room and my house. So the kid has a friend over for a play date. The special needs kid assumes we're in my castle now. We're going to play the games I want. We're going to do the things I want to do. I'm going to control the way this goes. Well, if you know, the real host relationship is just the opposite of that. You're supposed to bow to the guest. The guest is supposed to be the one who makes many of the decisions. So right away, it's going to be a challenge because this kid is going to, it's my house, it's going to be my rules, I'm going to do what I want. So explain to them, you're going to be the host. I will expect you to meet the kid at the door. We'll role play that. You're expected to introduce the child to the family, bring him in the living room where grandpa is and introduce him to grandpa. We're going to expect you to help me clean the house up a little bit before it comes and clean up a little bit afterwards and really begin to teach the curriculum of being a host, okay? Some other things you want to avoid, never invite two kids, never an odd number of kids. As soon as there's an odd number of kids, there's going to be one kid left out, and you can pretty much guess who it's going to be. Always just invite one kid. And I learned this from experience. We've got some nephews with learning problems. And he had a, I happened to be visiting when he had a friend come over for a play date. And the kid, the friend walked, friend, I'm using a little bit loosely, but the kid walks in the room and my nephew, who's a really sweet kid, goes up to him and says, "Now you listen to me. I'm working on a model over there. Do not touch it. If you go near that model, I've been working for 2 weeks." I'm thinking, you know, so what do I recommend to the parents? If there's something like that that might set your kid off, put it away. Put it in the closet so it doesn't become an issue. You know, just put it away. Some people don't agree with this, but I've got the microphone. jettison the sibs. Say to the sibs, "Michael's got a play date today. You guys need to go to the playground." Because if the sibs are there, they're going to be, almost by definition, more attractive social partners. And it'll end up with the play date playing with your other kids while your guys left out. Hover. The first 5-10 minutes, hang around. Mom, dad, hang around. And the last 10 minutes, and you know, there's a lot of research that shows that kids tend to remember the last part of any experience. You know, a kid sees a 2-hour movie and you ask them to tell you about it and he tells you about the last 5 minutes. They tend to remember the end of any experience. So make the end go well, you know, have some cookies, something to drink, and make sure the last 10 minutes before mom shows up, the last 10 minutes are fun and he might remember it as well. But you really do need to make it right. And that's the in-house one. The outside one, this is a mistake that so many parents make. If you're taking your kid to a new social experience, you've got, because a parent of a kid with special needs, you've got two jobs: prepare the child for the situation and the situation for the child. And here's what you do. Your kid wants to take a ceramics class. The class starts on Tuesday evening. On Monday evening, you take the kid to the empty classroom and say, "Look, this is where you're meeting, this is where you're going to be tomorrow. There's a flag over there. I know you love flags. Why don't you go mess with that now? Take it off and wave it around, do whatever you want to do, because I know you like flags, and that'll get that out of your system. Let's see where the closest boys' room is. This is the kiln. You want to make sure you don't get near that. But, you know, she's using this kind of computer, and that's just like your dad's. You know, you could say to her, if you need help running the projector, I know how to do that." So the kid is familiar with the setting. So the next day when he goes, he's got a lot of new stuff to learn, but he knows where the bathrooms are. He knows what to touch. He's touched the flag. He's done all those things he wants to do. So he feels more comfortable. That's prepare the child for the situation. What parents often fail to do is prepare the situation for the child. And that is to call the ceramics teacher and say, "Look, I'm sending you a kid, going to be in your program. He's a great kid. And he loves art and he happens to be very, very creative. But let me tell you something. He has problems that make it difficult for him to understand directions. And he's got a thing that when you give a direction, he nods and looks like he gets it, but he really doesn't. You know what we found really useful? When you give him a direction, have him repeat it back to you. And that's how we can tell he really understands. Because he's gotten pretty good at making believe he understands when he doesn't, because he doesn't want to be. And give, so you prepare the situation for the child. In my motivation book, I got a lot of good feedback on this. I put together a dossier. I mean, with all due respect and affection, you wouldn't leave your dog with someone for a weekend without giving him a list of kind of instructions and the care and feeding of the dog.
Right.
And it's kind of a 3-page dossier that the parent prepares and gives it to the soccer coach, the Boy Scout leader. And it just says, "This is what this kid's about. This is some things you might want to know about him. These are some things. He's startled by loud noises in a very age-inappropriate way. It's part of his problem. If you know the bell's going to ring or you know there's going to be a loud noise, if he knows ahead of time, that's all good. You know, why not be preventive and proactive rather than wait till the thing falls apart and then have a dispute with the coach or the teacher or whatever?" So prepare the child for the situation and the situation for the child. You know, you pull up the supermarket and you say, "I know when we go to the market, you love to go look at the lobsters and go look at the gross meat, the pig's ears and stuff. But you know what? We don't have time today. We just don't have time. I got to get a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread. So why don't you come with me?" Instead of going there and having a scene, prepare the child for the situation. This is what we can do. Next time we come, you can go look at the lobster to your heart's content. That's weekly shopping. But this is just something quick, in and out. Preparing the child for the situation rather than dealing with the crisis goes a whole lot smoother.
And I can hear parents in my head saying, "But I want everybody to accept my child as they are. I don't want to tell them that my child is different.
Yeah.
And what do you say to that?
Before I'm getting old and cranky, and to be perfectly honest, I don't have a lot of patience with that because it doesn't make a great deal of sense. The kid hasn't committed a crime. You know, it's just like, you know, a father will say to me, I don't want to give him awards for when he gets his room cleaned or something. I don't want to do a reward program. I don't want to bribe my kid. Just I've said to this parent this the other day, a bribe means rewarding somebody for doing something wrong. You know, I'm going to give a cop $20 so he don't give me a ticket. A bribe means doing something, giving an award for doing something wrong. I'm talking about incentives, which is giving. It's not a bribe. It's an incentive. You're giving them a reward for doing something right. So get that out of your system. You know, and this is going to sound maybe more harsh than I mean it, but if the parent doesn't want the Boy Scout leader to know the kid has a learning problem, that's not the kid's problem. That's mom and dad's problem. I mean, it's not the kid's fault. He didn't do anything wrong. You shouldn't be embarrassed. And part of your job as an advocate for him is to clear the path for him. And that's why I love this dossier thing, because it just gives, this is what the deal is. This is what is experience. And we're available to help in any way that we can. But this is the care and feeding of this kid. It tends to go much smoother. And I'll tell you where the idea came from. I had a woman who I knew well in town, and she called me. She said, Michael was thrown out of the Little League because he has learning disabilities. And I said, well, what do you mean? He was thrown out of the Little League because he's got dyslexia. Yes, he does. I don't want to file a lawsuit. And I want them all drawn and quartered. I said, okay, who was the coach? She said, Rob Raquel. I said, well, I know Rob Raquel. There's no way in the world that Rob Raquel pulled the kid off the team because he has dyslexia. That just didn't happen. He happened to be a teacher. He wasn't a special ed teacher, but that didn't happen. So we looked into it. Here's what happened. The kid had his first practice. He was really, really good, went to his left, went to his right, really good. In fact, he did so well that the coach was really impressed. And so at the end of practice, there were new rules for stealing bases in Little League, and there was a little handout they put together. And he said, we got a new handout about stealing bases. In fact, Rob, you did such a great job. Why don't you read it to the group? Now, he was doing it as a reward. So the kid put the thing down and wouldn't read it. He said, coach said, I just asked you to read that. No, I won't. Would you please read it? No, I won't. And he said, fine, and then you won't play for a week either. That was a very understandable response from the coach because he had no idea. If the parent had taken a moment to stop by, he wanted to tell you something about Mike. He's a great ball player, moves great to his left and right, and he really loves baseball, but he has a great deal of difficulty reading if that ever comes up. If she'd have taken that proactive measure, that never would have happened. The coach wasn't being a jerk. He just couldn't understand why this kid all of a sudden was shutting down and wouldn't cooperate. That's what gave me the idea of this dossier, that this very simple thing that just says, these are the things you ought to know about this kid. And again, with great respect and affection, I make the analogy to dropping your dog off with somebody for the weekend. You do the same thing. You wouldn't expect that they would know the intricacies of the behavior of that animal.
Right. And that whole shutting down thing, another area that I really love to work with is people who are exhibiting unwanted behaviors. And mm-hmm. I always say that all behavior is communication. So that mm-hmm. behavior right there was him communicating, not what the coach was expecting to be communicated, but that was how he knew to communicate at that point. Like, I'm not going to read because that's going to embarrass me. And then, you know, all the positive stuff I've earned this hour is going to go out the window because suddenly they're going to learn I don't know how to read.
Well, you know, when I do a workshop on motivation, I say the phrase unmotivated kid is a misnomer because it's impossible. But the definition, every human behavior is motivated. Every human behavior is motivated. So I use the example, if somebody walks out of my lecture right now, I can't say she wasn't motivated. She's motivated to walk out. So the coach said, this kid is not motivated because he wouldn't read. No, he was motivated to avoid being embarrassed. That was the motivation. So to say this kid is totally unmotivated, well, you don't understand human motivation because every human behavior is motivated. Kid sitting in the back room with his head in the desk, don't tell me he's not motivated. He's motivated to sit there with his head on the desk. All behavior is motivated. And as you said, all behavior is communication.
Yeah. And I do presentations about behaviors. And I say that all the time. Like, we have to become like a two-year-old when a kid is exhibiting a behavior and ask why. Why are they doing it? And, you know, we say that there are four or five functions, but that's not even a deep enough level. Why is that? Why do we think that's the function of the behavior? You know, is there what's going on? There's something else going on. And they often tell me, you know, like when I try to give them the incentive ideas, they will say things to me like, well, you know, they should be intrinsically motivated instead of extrinsically motivated. And because I'm presenting to teachers, I ask them, why are you sitting in this room with me today? Is it because you have to get professional development hours to get your continuing license? Well, yeah, that's part of it. I said, that's an extrinsic motivation.
Of course it is.
I mean, I would come and sit and listen to you any day of the week, all day long, and not be paid for it. But that's not who I am to the majority of the people that I'm presenting to. So they have to have some sort of extrinsic motivation for a while, at least. I mean, we all go to work and get paychecks. If we didn't get a paycheck after a certain amount of time, most of us probably wouldn't go to work.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, my motivation book called Motivation Breakthrough, and I hate the name of it. The Simon & Schuster came up with the name, and you know, you fight the battle, you can win. They said motivation needs to be in it. That makes sense. So anyway, but long story. But the title I wanted for the book is Batteries Not Included. The kids don't come with batteries included. It's your job to motivate kids. And for my money, when a teacher brings a kid into my office and says, this kid's not learning because he's not motivated, I don't look at the kid, I look at the teacher and say, well, what are we doing about that? That's part of your job. For my money, and I love teachers, I am a teacher, married to a teacher, 5 best friends are teachers, but for my money, when a teacher says, this kid's not learning because he's not motivated, is the same as a car salesman saying to his boss, I didn't sell any cars this month because they didn't have any motivated buyers. That's your job to motivate the buyer. Don't tell me you didn't sell any cars, you didn't motivated buyers. That's your job. Yeah. That's what you get paid for. And the idea that a teacher saying, this kid's not learning because he's not motivated, then what are you doing about that? We've taken the whole thing of motivation and put it on the kid. It used to be, we used to think it was our job to motivate kids. Now we think the kids should come with batteries included, and they're just not included. It's a whole different way of looking at motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Rick, just like the last time, as I said just a couple of minutes ago, I could sit and talk to you all day long every day of the week because I just feel like you have such great wisdom and I have such a parallel thinking to yours that, you know, we could.
If you and I agree, then we both must be right. There's no other explanation.
I'm all about that. I'm going to make sure to make that a snippet and put that out as my advertisement for today.
Well, you know, I do a lot of these, and I'm kind of semi-retired now, so it's actually fun to do this kind of thing. But the reason I was more than willing to jump in again is it's just you ask good questions, it makes sense. You know, people want solutions. There's a bunch of solutions. You know, teachers say, you know, I've tried everything. No, you've tried one thing a lot of times. That's what you've done. You know, Franklin Roosevelt got America through some of our most difficult times. And when he was first elected president, he passed the one line letter to everybody in his administration, basically said, do something. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else, which I think is great for parents and teachers. Don't keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting something to be different. You know, I talk about teacher bringing a kid in my office. I've kept Ali in for recess 15 days in a row, and he still isn't doing his math homework. Well, let's circle a slow learner in this picture, okay? It's not working. You might want to try something else. So anyway, the reason I'm glad to jump on, and we'll do it again sometime, is that you guys, you come up with good questions, and it's always fun. So,
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Fran, and anyone else who has joined us today. I very much appreciate it. Please be sure to like or subscribe to this channel so you catch all of my episodes. This was episode number 130, and I hope to double that and keep on going. So if you know of anybody who would like to share their story, please have them reach out to me through my email. They can find it on the YouTube page or through the Facebook page. It's really easy. It's Shelley@ShelleyKino.com. And I was going to pop it up really quick, but no, I can't find it. Oh, here it is. There it goes. Well, that's my website. That's ShelleyKino.com, but that's the same way you reach out to me, Shelley@ShelleyKino.com, and you will get me. And that's what I'm here for, guys. I want to share the stories. I want to bring awareness to everybody who has a disability and the great things that they are doing and that they are passing so many limits that others set upon them just because they're different in some way. So thank you very much, Rick, again. I so appreciate you for jumping on. I literally asked you yesterday and you came on today. So you have just no idea what that did to my heart. But thanks, everybody. Have a great week. Talk to you again.
Bye-bye.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.